Hello, and welcome to Knock Off Drinks with a Difference. I'm your host, Amy Armstrong, passionate non-alcoholic expert and sober socialite. Grab your favorite glass of non-alcoholic wine and join me on the couch for a chat about all things alcohol-free.
Okay, so today on the couch, I am joined by the beautiful Andy Quinn of Etch Sparkling. So,
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Andy. I've asked Andy to come on today, not necessarily to talk about Etch so much, but to talk about sort of the story behind Etch, the things that happened in her life before Etch began. And I guess it was sort of a part of why Etch began. Because, like, I mean, I know Andy and Jason's story, but a lot of people may not. And I think it's a really important one to share because Andy's story is one from someone who's been on the other side of the fence, who's had to deal with the shocking drinker. And that's not, I mean, we talk about our own drinking experiences a lot, and there's so much narrative around that, but there's not often a lot of discussion around what it's like to have to deal with that and be on the other side. So that's why I wanted to talk to you today, Andy, and I'm very, very grateful that you are happy to come and talk about this, because I think it is a really important topic for people to kind of get their heads around, and it's something that a lot of people are experiencing and can relate to.
Yeah, I think whenever I have to go back to that place in my head, it's quite a challenging one because life's so different now to what it was back then. So I'm just going to put myself back in that place because I know by doing that it's helping other people. And I think, you know, for me, when I was going through this experience, I didn't see people out there like me who were going through the same thing. So I'm happy to share for, you know, if it can help some people out there. So yeah,
good. Well, thank you. So do you just want to sort of start at the start, I guess explain a little bit about like Jason's sort of journey and what happened there, and we'll just work it out as we go along?
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, so Jason and I met, it's a bit scary, I was thinking it's over 20 years ago now. It feels like about 4 years ago, but we were both working at a Melbourne food and wine event. It was called The Longest Lunch in Sorrento in Victoria, in the Sorrento Park. And it was Jason and I were both working for small family wineries and serving wine to the 100 guests sitting there having their special lunch. It was a lovely day. We had lunch that day, connected, and formed a friendship, right, basically. And then a couple of years later, when I came back from travelling overseas, we started dating, and flash forward, had two beautiful children who are now 15 and 12. But for most of the period of our relationship, wine was integral, you know, as it was our income, it was our friendship circle, pretty much everything revolved around the wine industry. So we owned our own wine business, and Jason was working for, at that time, some large Australian wine brands. And as the years progressed and, you know, life stresses progressed, his drinking increased, so, you know, in direct proportion to what was going on with life. And I think Jason put a lot of pressure on himself to pay off the mortgage and provide for the family, which I always sort of think were pressures that weren't necessarily coming from me. I think men, whether that's a generalisation, but men tend to put a lot of pressure on themselves to be the provider. And yeah, so over that time, his drinking increased, and for the majority of the time, it looked really normal. But around 2017, Jason said to me, you know, I've got a problem. I think I've got a problem with drinking. And I said, what are you talking about? Like, it didn't look to me like a problem at that point.
What did it look like at that point, to you?
To me, it looked the same as everyone else. I didn't know any different. He was able to have time off. He could do days off. I think he tended to not drink Monday to Thursday, but he would drink on the weekends. But maybe it had been ramping up and I just hadn't noticed it. So when things started to get a little bit hairy, I noticed things like empty wine bottles being stacked back into the wine rack, and empty bottles sort of in the office, or and it just started to spark off red flags in my head. But again, because he behaved normally, he was holding down a good job, I didn't really think anything was strange was going on. So,
and he, and like when he was drinking, he wasn't like being an asshole, or like he wasn't antagonistic, or like his behavior when he was drinking, how was that?
Yeah, no, he's, the worst he would do is fall asleep. So he was always, I wouldn't even say the happy drunk. He was just, yeah, he's at worst when he was really, really drunk, which, you know, I'd only ever see if he was on a bender at a, you know, like his 40th birthday, for example. He'd just repeat himself. That was, so it was annoying to be around at that point. But there was no violence. There was no aggression. There was nothing really from my perspective that was really alarming, other than the fact that he told me he had a problem. And I think that's really an important thing to know, is that, you know, that he had that intuition there, and he, I think he'd had that for a long time, because I do recall when our daughter was only little, him saying, I think I've got a problem back then.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, don't be silly, what are you talking about? So I think that's a really important thing to note, is that intuition's often there, but we push it away. And so if you can listen to that voice, hopefully you don't go down the path that we had to. So it got to the point there where I think once Jason acknowledged there was a problem, that's when the hard work started. So he then realised that he couldn't stop. And so he'd gone to a GP and sought out some support and things like that. But, yeah, it was probably a period of 18 months to 2 years after that period that things were getting, you know, his drinking was becoming out of control, so he couldn't stop.
So at that point when things were starting to get really, really, you know, bad and he had lost control, how were you feeling? How was that affecting you at that time?
Well, it was very confusing, I think, because this man who had always been very moral and had, as far as I know, you know, never deceived me, I had started to notice that he was hiding things from me and telling me one thing. And so I started to not trust myself. I think that was the hardest thing, that, you know, I would say, you know, have you been drinking? And he'd say no. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe he's telling me the truth. But I think, again, I knew deep down that that wasn't the case. So, yeah, I sort of switched into how can I support him? And, you know, I started reading a lot, so I would try and understand where he was coming from, because it was just so, I'd never known anyone to have a drinking problem before. Like, when I think about it, I think everyone has a drinking problem. But to me, there were only, it was that man in the gutter with a brown paper bag. And Jason certainly didn't look like that. Yeah. So it was very confusing. I remember Googling something at one stage saying, you know, what's the difference between a high-functioning alcoholic and a, you know, and the man in the gutter? And the answer was time.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
Yeah. And so that was pretty, yeah, so it was a very stressful time. There was not a lot of hope when I was doing my doctor Googling, or the statistics that I was reading were pretty, was pretty gruesome about recovery and how hard it was, which now I know that's not the case. So, you know, I want to talk about the positives of, you know, recovery and the fact that you can make it out the other side.
Yeah. But at that time, like, I know for me in my relationship, like, I was, when I got really bad, I was getting a lot of ultimatums, and there was a lot of attempts to kind of like control what I was doing, and that only really made things worse. Like, what was your approach with him?
There was never any ultimatums. It was more about he wanted to stop, so how could I help him? like I say, there was the confusion when he'd say he wanted to do something, but then he wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But me, it was more like putting tools under his nose. So I would put podcasts, books, I'd email him, you know, articles, and sometimes he'd read them and sometimes he wouldn't. But yeah, that it was never an ultimatum because I knew it was, I knew, and he was able to articulate to me most of the time, you know, that he didn't want to drink. So I knew there was a lot of shame around it. It wasn't like he wanted to be doing this.
Yeah.
So I read a book, called When Your Partner Has an Addiction, and it was talking about dealing with compassion, and so that was the way, and it's probably my nature anyway, but it was trying to deal with him with compassion and understanding rather than why don't you do this, why, you know. And I also came from it that he, it wasn't him, it was an illness that he was going through. So that behaviour wasn't the husband that I knew. It was because of an illness. So that was, yeah.
Yeah. And so then what happened?
So, yeah, so we started to research rehab facilities because he wasn't, it wasn't working, him doing it on his own. And at that point he had his dream job. He was working for a very large French family wine business looking after Australia Pacific region, and really it would have been his dream job. And, you know, I had said to him, if you had a broken leg right now, you'd go into hospital and get it fixed. And this was the same thing. He needed to get some treatment. But he was probably 7 months into this new job and he didn't want to let them down. So he just kept pushing himself and pushing himself. And it got to a point, I mean, it got pretty awful. You know, he was hiding the quantities that he was drinking. And he ended up getting to the point where we call it the fuck it button, and he purchased a large quantity of alcohol and consumed it. And I don't know whether the intention was to end his life or not. I think there was an element of that there. And he ended up in intensive care on life support.
Jesus.
So that was the pivotal point. So he ended up going into rehab for 3 weeks, which was really interesting. We took the kids in to see him in there, and I think that was one thing with Jason too. He kept himself accountable by telling people. So, you know, he always spoke to his mum and dad, and he spoke to me about things. So if, you know, if he was slipping and having a hard time, he would go around and visit his mum and dad and say, this is what's going on. So the beauty of that was being able to share with kids and explain what was happening. Which I think was really important to share that part of the journey with them. Like I said, they didn't see anything untoward because he was never violent or aggressive, but I explained to them that he wasn't well and needed to go and get some help. So when he came out of rehab, he unfortunately had a slip again a little while later, but I think, you know, I don't think of these things as failures anymore. I think of them as learning. So he, yeah, I think he had 2 slips after rehab. It wasn't a quick fix, unfortunately. That would have been nice. But but from my perspective, yeah, it was just this, you know, you're constantly on edge.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like you're just waiting for something to go wrong almost.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, as I say, like it's really hard to take myself back there because I just feel so far from that place now. But in that time, I remember tracking where he was just to make sure he was where he said he was going to be. He started going to anonymous meetings and he had some support through people there, which was, I think every time I saw him doing something, you know, a step in that direction, it gave me comfort.
When did you kind of breathe and like get a sense that this is going to stick and he's on the straight and narrow and you can stop worrying about him?
It's a really good question, because there was definitely not a point. It's always a slight easing of. So every time I checked the app and he was where he said he would be, that would kind of be this little release. Mm. Every time, because I, you know, I don't know about you, but I find I'm a really good detective. And, you know, I was checking out what he was saying and doing, and he was telling me the truth. So I think it was always more him showing me that he was doing the right thing. And obviously I could tell his behaviour, you know, I knew he wasn't drinking. But it was probably a very long time that I felt safe. Mm. I mean, a very long time before I left, you know, left him on his own. I did sort of worry about what I would come home to. Yeah. Knowing the kids were with him was sort of like a safety for me as well. Mm. Yeah, so there was never that release. It gradually happened, and it would probably be 6-12 months maybe before. Yeah. Like, I don't now think, what if, you know, get home and, but, you know, hopefully that's never going to happen. But yeah, that thankfully that anxiety feeling, which was, I was living in a constant state of anxiety for a very long time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And, like, with you working in the wine industry as well, I mean, you obviously had a fondness for wine, mm-hmm. but no problems. So did you immediately decide that you had to stop drinking yourself? And, like, what did that totally change your relationship with alcohol?
Yeah, so when early on in the piece, when I sort of noticed he was drinking a lot, for example, I'd open a bottle of Chardonnay to go with my dinner, and he would finish the bottle. And so in an effort to try and help him drink less, I would just not have that glass of Chardonnay. So I altered my behaviour. But then, you know, when things were really rough with him, alcohol really repulsed me. Mm. It lost its sheen for me. I just thought, how can this substance that's killing my husband be a source of joy? And so really, yeah, I had no interest in drinking. So I stopped drinking before he did and gave myself 12 months and said, you know, I'll just see how I go. And then I got to 12 months, and then we were in lockdown for like two years after that. So, again, it's been now 4.5 years, and I don't have the urge to pick up a drink.
No.
But, yeah, like you say, I never was a big drinker beforehand. I like to always be in control, and I like to be able to be there for the kids if they needed to be picked up or driven somewhere or something. Yeah. So,
and so when did he leave the wine industry?
Well, he emailed his resignation from the rehab hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. He just realised that had to go.
Yeah.
And then was like, now what am I going to do?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, he'd attempted so many times to moderate his drinking while he was working in the wine industry. But we had access to a very large wine allowance. You know, we'd have over $1,000 a month wine allowance of that was, you know, wholesale prices. So we had a lot of access to wine. Plus we had our own wine business as well. So he resigned, and after that he actually worked as a landscape gardener for 12 months.
Yeah.
And I think the reason he went to landscape gardening was because when he originally got into wine, it was the agricultural side of things that he loved. Mm. He loved the growing of the wine and the making the wine. But so connecting to earth, and I think that really formed part of his recovery. So he worked for about 12 months doing that. In that time, you know, the concept of Etch came about. And I remember, you know, having a conversation with him saying, well, for starters, we were like, well, what are we going to drink when we go out? So we'd have social occasions and we'd take, you know, a bottle of kombucha maybe or sparkling water. I'd take along like a sparkling water with a Tupperware container of cut up limes and, you know, it was just – so, yeah, so I said to him, why don't we create an alcohol-free drink that doesn't replicate alcohol, that gives people that same ritual, that same sense of inclusion that having an alcoholic drink does, just minus the booze. Mm. And I watched the lights come on in his eyes at that moment and, yeah, off he went to create Etch. So, yeah, Etch stands for Every Time Choose Health.
Yeah.
And I think when you hear the backstory, you can sort of understand that health piece is around, you know, the alcohol consumption piece. It's also around the fact that there's no sugar or preservatives in the drinks. So it's physical health, it's spiritual health, it's, you know, connecting with your intuition, listening to that inner voice, and also like the health of the planet in that, you know, the health of our soils, because we use Australian native ingredients that are sustainably farmed, that are, you know, they thrive in the Australian soils without irrigation and pesticides. So, yeah, the other important thing to mention too was that when Jason was in his early recovery, he was going on healing walks with a local Indigenous educator, Lionel Louch from Living Culture, and he was showing him the native ingredients or native edibles as he was taking Jason on these walks. And Jason, you know, was picking berries and eating leaves on these paths that he'd run. He's a runner and he had run down these paths many, many times. And his mind was just blown that, you know, there's these ingredients that First Nations Australians have been using as food and medicine for many, many thousands of years. And, you know, really they were part of the medicine in him getting well too. Yeah. So
it's really beautiful, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. I think, you know, I think that's something we're really passionate about too with Etch, is that showcasing these native ingredients that, you know, some of these ingredients, they just, like, for example, the Kakadu plum, that has more vitamin C than any food in the whole world.
What?
I know. And yet, can you buy them anywhere? Like,
yeah,
it's amazing. And, you know, often foods are compared to blueberries because of their antioxidant levels, and native Australian ingredients blow the blueberries out of the water. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing. So that's a really exciting part of the business too.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's such a good, like, holistic view of health, isn't it? And it's so amazing that, like, his journey and your journey is then going on and helping other people in their journey.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I know the 12th step of AA is giving back to others. And so, yeah, we like to think of Etch as a message in a bottle, and that, or a can. yeah, so, you know, to start that conversation and, yeah, hopefully be able to help other people.
So if you had any advice for someone who is in what was your position, sees their partner struggling, what would your advice be?
I talk about putting the oxygen mask on yourself, so you can get really carried away with trying to help someone else. But I think the sad fact is you can do nothing if they don't want to stop drinking. You have absolutely no control. I thought the fact that he loved me and he loved our children would be enough to stop, but it isn't. So for me, it would be about looking after yourself. And however that looks, it can be really simple things. But, yeah, reading lots of books. To me, again, it was about understanding where Jason was coming from. Podcasts. I mean, gosh, how life's changed in that 4 years. So there was no sobriety podcasts back then. there was not many. Well, I didn't know of any options. I mean, the podcast I listened to that really helped me was a podcast called Addicted, but it was a story of a couple who he'd made it out the other side, but yeah, it wasn't a light fluffy thing. So I think there's a lot more out there at the moment.
Yeah,
a lot more support, and just find your tribe, find a support group. The Instagram, social media is amazing out there.
Yeah.
So there's lots of hope.
Yeah, good. Well, I think you're very brave, and I think it's very generous of you to share this story. I think there are people out there who this will help, and it will resonate with them a lot. So I think it's pretty amazing that you and Jason that you're willing to put it out there.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you. It's lovely to have a chat. Forget my microphone. Yeah. Lovely to have a chat, and as always. So thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, everyone.
As always, head to drybutwet.com.au for all the latest non-alcoholic drinks reviews, and head to drybutwet on Instagram for hilarity and entertainment. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe and share this podcast if you think that anyone could benefit from it. See you next week. Cheers.